Украина! Россия!
Мы здесь, власть! Мы
For more than 9 months now, it's been a regular feature of the Russian landscape. Tens of thousands of people gather in Moscow, thousands in St. Petersburg and other cities. They carry signs with clever and often hilarious anti-government slogans. They chant things like Russia without Putin, Putin is a thief, and we are the power here. They listen to fiery speeches by Alexei Navalny, Sergei Udaltsov, and other opposition figures. And then everybody goes home. Until the next protest is called. The early demonstrations last December on Bolotnaya Площadь and Prospekt Sakharov were widely interpreted as a show of strength by a rejuvenated opposition, proof that true dissent was real and blossoming in Russian society, and the Kremlin's foes could consistently put people on the streets in large numbers. But after the last rally earlier this month, which had a bit of a pro forma feel to it, many in the media, including outlets sympathetic to the opposition, began to question the utility of street protests as a vehicle for change. And there are signs that the opposition is aware that it needs to deploy new tactics. A big test will come next month when they will hold online primaries, the first of their kind in Russia, to choose a 45-member coordinating council that will decide things like who will run in which elections and when, where, and why future street protests will be held. Russia's opposition is having growing pains. Can they now take it to the next level? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Kirill, I want to discuss the utility of the street protests in a bit, but first let's talk about these online primaries. Alexei Navalny had a press conference earlier this week about them, and it seems to me the current leaders of the opposition are taking them very, very seriously and very much want to get them right. In a nod to the diversity of the opposition, seats on the council are reserved for nationalists, liberals, and leftists. Organizers have formed their own electoral commission to assure a free and fair vote. Dozh TV, the online television station, is hosting debates. How important a step is this for the opposition, these primaries?
Let's begin with Vladimir Lenin.
You always begin with Vladimir Lenin.
Yes, right? I prefer to begin with Vladimir Lenin because he was the, you know, he opened with his comrades, he opened a new era of Russian history.
Yes.
So we have to do this.
Lenin
spoke in one of his pre-revolution works, one of his papers. He spoke about two cultures in modern Russia, in the beginning of 20th century, mm-hmm. of course. He was not a prophet. He just tried to analyze the situation before the revolution in the 1910s. So he wrote about two cultures. One culture is a culture of elite, nobles, aristocracy, bourgeois class, and so on. And another one is people's culture, proletarian culture, and so on. And he tried to divide these two cultures. He was not correct, I think. But the intention was that it's not just two cultures. This division is based on the division of the, you know, economic and social realities.
Right.
And
yes.
And so I'd like to try to analyze. I'm not a Marxist, of course.
I hope not.
It's not so bad, you know. Marxist analysis is a basement of, I think, of a huge part of modern sociology and economic theories and so on.
But you're not dogmatic enough to be a Marxist.
No. It's not like, you know. Let's try to speak about this primaries on the internet, TV, Dozh, and so on, in the context and in terms of two cultures or two or several realities in modern Russia. Mm-hmm. So what do we see now, what do we watch now on Dozh TV? We watch a very interesting, very intriguing, very, you know, optimistic in some political sense, process or procedure of a real, you know, democratic elections to this coordination council, something like this. It's very good. I think everyone will agree that this procedure as itself is very, very, very good.
You almost like feel like you're watching a different country when you're watching this.
It's, yes.
It's a country that has open debate, free elections, fair rules of the game. It's you can't help but feel a little optimistic when you watch this.
But in Lenin terms, it's just one culture. Lenin, he never read all these anthropologists after the Second World War who use a word or term culture not in, you know, meaning that this is something about arts, literature, and so on.
Culture is a system of meaning.
Yeah. So in this meaning of the word, this is one of several Russian, modern Russian cultures. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, total. It's not the most, you know, strong in some sense. I'm not speaking that it's not the most important now in Russia. We don't know what's type of culture presumably is most important now in Russia. But we can agree that the events that are happening just now on the not TV screens, it's very important.
Computer screens,
it's internet culture, is creative cluster culture, and so on. This is very important for itself, but I am not sure that it's such important.
Let me interject here. Yeah? I think the important question is not whether it's the most important part of culture, but is it the rising part of the culture? And we can pull in some very recent historical examples around this. Why were some countries like Poland and Estonia, for example, so successful so quickly in their post-communist transition? One of the reasons, I think, was that even throughout the years of communism, there was this alternative civil society that was functioning parallel to the official communist structures, to the official communist culture. In Poland, it was around the Roman Catholic Church, of course. In Estonia, it was around the national movement, which kept the language alive and basically taught the values of civil society around these things. So when communism fell, there was almost like a civil society that was ready to come into place, come into being. Not that it wasn't without its own problems, but it certainly helped advance the transition. And we're looking at in these two countries had two of the more successful post-communist transitions, I would argue. Is something like that being built around this, what you call this urbane internet culture in Russia? And is this the rising
hipster culture?
Yeah, hipster culture. I mean, it'd be interesting if in Poland it was the church, in Estonia it was the national movement, and in Russia it was the hipsters.
Yeah.
Worse things could happen. Yeah. But is this, or is this a bunch of, you know, spoiled urbanites huddling around their computers? I suspect it's closer to the former than to the latter. What do you think?
I think that the situation in Poland or Lithuania or in Czech Republic, Estonia or in Czech Republic, I can say the same about Lithuania or Latvia in less. And the situation now in Russia are absolutely different.
Of course they
are. The question is, first of all, how long was the communist rule in these countries and in Russia? That is the most important thing, because during the first 10 or 15 years of Bolshevik rule, one part of, you know, this heritage or tradition of self-governing Russian communities, especially peasant communities, had been destroyed. And after that, Stalin's big terror destroyed all this, you know, tradition of a liberal class and some kind of system of horizontal ties in Russian villages and in Russian, especially in Russian cities, including intelligentsia.
I agree with you, but now when I look at this creative class and what they're doing, I'm impressed with their sophistication.
Yes, that's why we call them a creative class. They're creating a new kind of tradition from zero, absolutely zero level. But in Poland, in Estonia, in Czech Republic, and so on, all these movements, they had been established on the living tradition of some, you know, social phenomena or religious phenomena or political phenomena and so on. And that is the main difference between them. For Poland, for Estonia, for Czech Republic, traditionalism or conservatism means that, as we told in some of previous podcasts, that means that they are based on the living tradition of historical, you know, background of the countries, especially in 19th century and in the first third of 20th century. In Russia, we see there, you know, the birth of a new tradition, a new phenomenon.
That's very Russian,
yes,
I might add.
Yes, like Peter the First. So, in some sense, Navalny or, you know, people from Dozhd TV, they're descendants of Peter the Great.
I won't. as you said, they are building it from zero. And the key question now is, are they ascendant? Are they ascendant? Are they rising? And because they are one of many different cultures that exist, they have to compete with, you're right, ingrained habits and an ingrained culture that probably precedes, I would argue, precedes the communist period, actually. How hard is this going to be for this new civic culture that we're seeing? Because that's what comes to my mind as I watch this on Dozhd TV and as I listen to Navalny's press conference and look at what they're trying to do here. And they're trying to say, we are going to build our little democratic culture ourselves if need be, and hopefully sooner or later it will become the culture of the country.
Yeah. I think there are several points in this discussion about this. First of all, Soviet Union, Soviet intelligentsia has, it's interesting, but it has a special tradition of, you know, limited zones of freedom. It's not just about Soviet kitchens, intelligentsia kitchens, where Soviet people, you know, drank vodka and, you know, spoke about how bad is Brezhnev or something like this. I'm speaking not just about this. I'm speaking about limited territories, which had been established as a limited, you know, high-tech parks, technology parks during Soviet Union, but it was not about technology, it was about science. Dubna,
right.
All this, you know, university,
Novosibirsk,
and so on. So this is, and the situation inside these places was absolutely different from all over the country.
This is the tradition that Andrei Sakharov
emerged
from.
Yes, in some sense. So semi-official bards like Galich or Vysotsky could visit this place.
The rock club in Leningrad.
Rock club and so on. So this is a very important tradition in Russian and then in Soviet history.
And you had it under Putin in Putin's first stint in the Kremlin, things like Echo Moskvy, for example.
Yes, but now this zone of freedom is a whole internet.
Yeah.
That is the interesting.
And that's the whole country.
Yes. And this is, first of all, the whole country. This is, secondly, that there are no any borders just now. So far, there are no any borders, you know, national borders on the internet,
right.
Secondly. And thirdly, it's very interesting that this is a real challenge to this generation of Russian, you know, liberals, or anyway, this is a real challenge, because one thing, when you invent something very bright, very interesting, very, you know, talented, and you are so proud, you're in euphoria about this. We invented a real online democracy inside Putin's Russia.
Right.
Great. Good. Yeah. But then... another situation is beginning. So what to do with all this? How to spread all this invention? How to, cross the border between the invention and the implementation.
Well, this is exactly where we're at now. Now, we're saying the opposition now has to move beyond street protest into the next stage. What can they do? Well, one of the things they're doing is they're organizing themselves, the famously fractious and argumentative Russian opposition that can never agree with itself on pretty much anything, is going to organize in this little sub-society a democracy. And then once it's like what the founders of the American Constitution said, what have you done? We've created a republic if you can keep it. Well, what are you going to do with it after that?
Yes.
And that gets into the nuts and bolts of this. Now we've kind of discussed the theory of this, but this is, I mean, presumably next month we're going to have a 45 member body that's going to have at-large seats, that's going to have seats for nationalists, seats for liberals, seats for leftists, and they're going to decide what? Well, so far what I've seen is they're going to decide when and where to hold protests. Well, that's not that interesting to me. Sorry to the opposition, but we've been watching protests go off very successfully without this coordinating council for a while. They're also going to decide, and this is where it's going to get very interesting, who runs for which posts with the support of the entire unified opposition, which could be a powerful force in elections in the future. Now, again, are we going to, you know, are Udaltsov's people and Navalny's people
and
Nemtsov's people and nationalists, are they going to be able to agree who gets to run for, I mean, God knows what, the city council of Omsk? This is going to be
a real problem. Yeah.
Is the democracy going to be honored when it comes time for this council to make decisions? Is this council going to be able to make decisions? There's two tests here. First, can they pull this off? I think they can. They look very serious about this, and they seem to be taking all the right steps to make sure that this thing goes off well. Afterwards, rather than, you know, congratulating themselves and say, hooray, we've created a little democracy on the internet, now what? Are the decisions of this coordinating council going to be honored as democratically arrived at decisions? Or is everybody going to put their own little candidate up for every post, and you have a divided opposition which only plays into the hands of the Kremlin? What do you think?
That is another question, and that is another very serious problem for Russian Democrats. First of all, I absolutely agree. There are two different things: to invent something and then some sort of routine will come. And I think the time of euphoria and all these illusions that make politics or to attend the protests is kind of way to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
All these days are over.
Yeah.
And from now on, they have to, you know, this famous British slogan of during the Second World War, calm down and carry on.
Calm down and carry on.
So they have to calm down and carry on everyday struggle. This is not about having fun or something like this.
Right.
This is not, I'm not speaking about dirty work, but this is a real, you know, real labor.
Right.
In some, you know, maybe even in some physical sense.
Right.
It's a labor. It's mm-hmm. a hard labor. Secondly, I think maybe I'll be a little bit provocative, but I think the most painful problem for Russian Democrats ever was the problem of the results or outcomes of the democracy or democratic procedures.
Mm.
They adore or they praise all the democratic procedures, especially fair elections. But they never happy with the results.
Of course not.
And what do we see now?
And those that are happy with the results begin to interpret democracy as keep us Democrats in power. This was one of the problems of the Yeltsin years.
Yes. And secondly, they are very irritated with those who vote for wrong people. So they are very irritated with their own, you know, people. with Russian people, with all Russian society. That is very strange. If you are a Democrat, you have to, you know, respect their choice.
This touches on something. This came up with Mark Galeotti in one of the previous podcasts when you were on vacation, where we talked about, you know, is there one thing these people can all agree on? From Udaltsov on the left to Navalny and farther to the right to the harder core nationalists and liberals like Nemtsov in the middle, can they agree on rules of the game? Can they agree on something where they say, if we ever achieve our dream and overthrow this regime and come to power, will we agree that these are the rules of the game and we're going to respect it whether we like it or not? And that means liberals accepting if leftists win the election or nationalists win the election. And will nationalists or leftists who win the elections agree when their term is over to leave power and let maybe the liberals come in and everybody gets
and
their
respect
shot.
The rights of the respect the rights of the minority.
This is the whole thing, and it's something that struck me working as a correspondent in Russia in the 90s, is that people tended to see democracy as a result.
And that
where
is,
democracy is a process. It's not a result.
Yes,
it's
not a result. It's not an invention. This is a process. And moreover, we all believe that democratic procedures, this is a kind of universal value. But you have to adjust every time these universal values to the national features and so on. And secondly, I always remember this famous Pushkin's phrase, you know, Alexander Pushkin, the great Russian poet and whatever.
Everything goes back.
Everything, yes.
And, Putin это наше сил.
Pushkin, not Putin.
I said Pushkin это наше сил. I didn't say Putin. I would never say Putin это наше сил. I did.
Yes. So he said once in his, you know, conservative period of his life, the latest period of his life, that government is the only European in Russia. Government mm-hmm. is the only European in Russia. Правительство единственный европеец в России. This was not a kind of disappointment with some liberal ideas of Decembrists and so on. No. That was just analysis and the result of the analysis of the situation after the Decembrist uprising, mm-hmm. that all this conservative Russia with 90% of illiterate population under mm-hmm. the influence of Orthodox Church and the aristocracy and the nobles and whatever, so on, they cannot be Europeans, you know, in any sense. Mm-hmm. In any sense. Of course, the question is what does it mean to be European in, 1832 or 33 and so on. But we are not just discussing the historical context of this sentence or phrase. We are discussing the implication of this phrase to our modern history. So, This point of Russian opposition that Democrats are not always respecting the idea of the choice mm-hmm. and the results of democratic procedures, this is the most vulnerable point of Russian opposition, and the government, who mm-hmm. is not the only European now in Russia.
No, the government is far from the only
European. Far from this. Far from. But I think it's closer to be Europeans than, for instance, opposition nationalists. That is the question. And the government knows that this point is very vulnerable.
This is a vulnerable point in the opposition.
And they are trying to, to play a game as if the government is the only European now in Russia.
Meaning that the government is a more progressive force than the opposition.
Not just progressive, but they're trying to defend the core European values from, for instance, nationalists.
Mm.
And that is a very...
And they do this by jailing Pussy Riot, passing laws on blasphemy. I mean, there are problems there, too.
This is another part of this game. This is another part of this game. They need the support from some nationalist and orthodox circles and part of population. And that's why they are doing this and this and this. But at the same time, they're For instance, they're defending some universal or multicultural, even multicultural values in the multicultural, multi-ethnic country.
Right.
So don't forget about this. We cannot say that a Russian government or Putin's regime is nationalistic in ethnic in ethnic terms. It's not. It's opposing.
Although they play the ethnic card when it suits them.
Yes. That's why. But why does the regime play this card? Because they know about this vulnerable point.
Right.
And they're playing with all this, you know, paraphernalia around Pushkin's phrase and all this historical context. That's very interesting.
Now, before we briefly move on to the protests, I wanted to because I wanted to get your opinion about where protests are going. But first, I mean, looking at this now, everything we've discussed here about these primaries and what the opposition is trying to do in this virtual reality culture of democracy they've created online. Do you think, are you optimistic or pessimistic? Do you think they can, do you think they're up to the task? Because I think, it seems to me the opposition has matured quite a bit in Russia. And the democratic part of the elite, so to speak, because I think it's even matured since they were even in power to a degree in the Yeltsin period. Are they up to the task now? Do you think they can pull this off?
I can't be optimistic or pessimistic because I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But I think it's wrong from the point of view when we are trying to analyze the situation. Yes, but I'm hopeful that they are maturing the opposition. Who else? Nationalists, liberals, leftists, and so on. They're maturing and they're trying to come to terms with each other. Because not just because they have the only one enemy, Putin and, you know, his Kremlin, collective Kremlin and so on. But they are, I think, in some sense, they are the only politicians in Russia who are really concerned or, you know, interested in the future of the country. Not pragmatically, but they have various different, but they have this, you know,
they have a vision. They have a vision of what they want the future
of Russia to look like. Of course, I cannot agree with the nationalist perspective and so on. But anyway, they have something to discuss. They have something to offer to Russian society. And this regime just has nothing in this sense. So that's why I'm hopeful.
I would agree. I'm hopeful. I think the key test is if they can agree on rules of the game that they're going to honor. To me, that is the most important thing, and it's something that I'll certainly be looking for going forward. Very briefly, before we move on to the next segment, I wanted to get your take on what's the future of protests. Do protests still have any role here? The opposition's proved they can put people on the streets time and time again, and now it's kind of reached the point of so what? What role do protests play in the rest of
this? It's becoming slower and slower, and I think it's the process will go on in this direction. But
just to say we're still here.
Yes, but
it's almost an advertising ploy at this point. It's a marketing device at this point.
But till some other, you know, reason to not to uprise, but to go to the streets, like it was the elections in December, like it was, you know, elections.
Maybe after the October local elections.
Maybe after that, but I'm not sure. Maybe after some, you know, we can't predict which events will happen this autumn. But something could happen, and the division inside the elite, inside Kremlin, and so on, and we have to discuss this. So and I think maybe the next reason for such protests will come or will provoke from this side, from Kremlin, not from some other sides. Because, as I see, I am not happy with this, but the only, you know, generator of the political agenda now in Russia is still Kremlin.
And the Kremlin's been pretty silent. We're going to talk about this in the second half of the podcast. In a few moments, we'll shift the aperture from the Russian street and the culture of the internet to the halls of power. Speculation in the media that a government shakeup is coming soon has reached a fever pitch. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Ничего личного. Хочу это, чтобы вы знали.
Nothing personal. I want you to know it. Nothing personal. But I want to warn everyone else that I will be following our common work attentively and respond accordingly to what's going on.
Реагировать на то, что происходит.
That, of course, was President Vladimir Putin publicly chastising members of Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev's government this last week. Kirill, you and I were speaking off mic earlier in the week, and you noted something that I actually agree with, that there seems to be a lot going on with the opposition, with all these primaries and everything. And with the exception of Putin's little outburst there, the elite has been eerily quiet. What has been going on at this time, however, has been a lot of speculation in the media that a major government shakeup was coming later in the fall. The Daily Nezavisimaya Gazeta writes that this will probably happen sometime after Putin's birthday on October 7th because they don't want to spoil the festivities. And meanwhile, as I wrote on the blog last week, the entire elite appears locked in a cold war between the teams of Vyacheslav Volodin and Vladislav Surkov in the Kremlin, between Medvedev's government and Putin's Kremlin, between Siloviki and technocrats, between shareholders and managers and the broader elite. Is this just the calm before the storm here that we're seeing? Is this Cold War about to turn hot?
From the outsider's point of view, it's calm. It's very calm. But if we just, you know, analyze the last steps by Putin, or maybe his steps for several months, we'll see that he is degrading and humiliating Medvedev and his circle step by step from the very inauguration. He canceled almost everything which had been, you know, offered or proposed by Medvedev in the last period of his presidency. And just one thing survived. It's, you know,
I know what you're going to say. Go ahead, say it.
This is so-called the problem of the winter time. So-called.
Yeah, Medvedev invaded daylight. This is
the only Medvedev's legacy in Russian politics so far.
I would disagree with that in a broader sense, but because basically I argue that what Medvedev's legacy is the expectation that there is an alternative.
But the expectations from Kremlin are over.
And this expectation has generated what we talked about in the first half of this podcast, all this activity in the opposition. But it's also created divisions in the elite. It's not divisions about loyalty to Medvedev versus Putin. It's more desire for a more
psychological.
The desire and, in fact, the perceived need on the part of the elite for a more pluralistic system, and that this is Medvedev's legacy, that the elite is no longer monolithic. Medvedev, despite his weakness, or I would actually argue even because of his weakness, has left this legacy of an elite, part of which is not afraid to support a more pluralistic outcome. For example, and I've been reading about this in the press, and again, I wrote about this in the blog last week, inside the Kremlin, there are still remnants of Surkov's team that are just waiting for Volodin's more hardline approach to fail. When they could say, see, I told you so, this isn't going to work, society's different, we have to come at it with a much more pluralistic approach, at least externally, at least we have to fake pluralism a little better. Some want real pluralism. It's created divisions in between the government and the Kremlin, between the, as we've talked about in the podcast in the past, shareholders who have a stake in the current system, who are collecting oil rents and want to continue to collect oil rents, people like Sechin, of course, and managers like Alexei Kudrin, who, because they understand the economy, understand that this kind of model cannot continue. It's going to spell economic disaster for Russia. Kudrin understands this. He served the old system because he understood the old system would work under previous conditions. But now he understands, and this is why he's left the government, because this is just not going to work anymore. And we have to change the political system a little bit, or else we're going to face economic disaster. So these divisions are there. They're very real. I use the metaphor of a Cold War to describe them in my blog this past week. This Cold War is either going to be resolved one way or the other, or this Cold War is going to go hot. What do you see happening? I know you're not a prophet, so don't say I'm not a prophet.
I'm not a prophet. I can just suppose something. First of all, I think let's speak about the reality. We spoke about one reality, and yes.
now we're in another one of these cultures. That's Kremlin.
Also very limited reality, also with its own rules and values and so on. So I can suppose that till the beginning of this year, the expectations and some maybe political activity of those who are managers in your terminology, they were focusing their expectations on the figure, on political figure of Medvedev. Mm-hmm. Now they are deeply disappointed with him. Deeply
busy. Of course, ever since last September, a year ago.
Yes, but still they had some illusions. Still they had some illusions in the beginning of the year. But now I just suppose I'm going on supposing something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now they're trying to find another figure.
Kudrin, Prokhorov. There are figures
who else?
Out there.
Maybe we don't know even
or
the name.
Or somebody else
yes,
we don't know.
Yes, we even don't know the name. But without such, inside leader of this elite, they will fail. They have to, support someone who...
That they can coalesce around. I agree.
Embodied all this.
But as a counterpoint with that, and if you look at the elite and you look at the talent pool in the elite, I would argue that the best talent is with the side that is arguing for more pluralism. The best economic manager in the country is Alexei Kudrin, at least the best proven economic manager in
proven.
The country. There are certainly other good economic managers
there is some obscure genius.
But to bring macroeconomic stability to Russia after the 90s and in the atmosphere of mind-bending corruption and still keep the country in macroeconomically good shape is a Herculean task. And he did this. So we could say they have probably the best team of economic managers around Kudrin in the country are with the people that want more pluralism. The best political manager in the country, I don't think listeners of this podcast will be surprised to hear that I think is Surkov. I mean, the guy is a very good political manager. He's operated in different systems. The Yeltsin system and it's no secret that he served every Kremlin until now in the post-Soviet world. You have the best political manager and the best economic manager and their teams that are on the side of easing things up and having a more pluralistic system. You see the B team working for Russia's current rulers right now. And I'm sorry, I think Volodin is the B team. Compared to Surkov, I think the people managing the economy now are the B team compared to Kudrin. So that's what that side has going for it. What they're hoping for, if I can believe the tea leaf reading I'm reading in the Russian press, what I'm reading in places like Nezavisimaya Gazeta and Gazeta.ru and on the blogs and on LiveJournal, they're just biding their time because they just know that this is going to end in disaster for the current leaders, and they're going to be able to step in and be the saviors. That's the Cold War being resolved in a relatively peaceful fashion on the side of one or the other. There's a less happy outcome, and that is this Cold War going hot.
Hot. In some sense, I can agree with you, but let's introduce some, historical limitations or borders about what I am saying now. I agree, Kudrin and Surkov were the best economic and political managers and so on. In the situation or in the context of economic growth, and Putin first and second version.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they still are the best for recent situation of economic recession and Putin 3.0, third version. So I'm not sure that Surkov is still efficient in this sense, because he was very, you know, effective and successful during the times of not public politics, but kind of mixture, you know, of rumors, intrigues, and some public protests, but not so mass protests and so on. But now, in some sense, the situation became simpler. Than it was. The situation was very complicated, not complicated, but sophisticated in 2000s. But
you mean
now,
his political technology does not match the political reality we have.
Yes.
That's an interesting point, and that's a point well taken.
It's like you know, James Joyce's Ulysses in comparison with Ernest Hemingway's prose. You know, it's time to the, you know, the total simplicity.
Yeah, although in Surkov was the one arguing that saw this coming and that said, if I can believe what I've been reading, because I don't know what he said, I wasn't in the room, but if I could believe the accounts I've read, that he was the one that is arguing society's changing, it's becoming more sophisticated, we cannot rule it in this top-down way, we have to create at least the illusion of pluralism. That advice was not listened to. And that, along with that, meant Medvedev stays in the presidency, because we cannot have this situation where it looks like Medvedev was just a placeholder for Putin. That's going to inflame society. We need more parties in the Duma. We need a more vibrant Duma that just doesn't look like the Ministry of Implementation for the Kremlin. Right. So he was arguing that Kudrin was arguing and is arguing that Russia is dangerously dependent on commodities and energy, and that the economy needs to be diversified. And that in order to diversify the economy, you must diversify the political system. I think these truths still hold. Yes, he is arguing for some austerity in the budget, which is tough in a period of a recession. But he's hardly alone in terms of economic managers in the world in that regard. So your point is well taken, and it remains to be seen whether they are up to the task of operating in the current current climate. I think the ideas they've put forth up to now are certainly better than anything the Putin team is putting forward in terms of moving Russia forward.
Yes, just a brief note. It's a kind of paradox that while society is becoming more and more sophisticated now in Russia, measures of political or tools of political struggle is becoming simpler and simpler.
Yeah.
And that is very interesting and that is very dangerous. Because
you mean the Kremlin is using the blunt instrument of repression
against the opposition use, you know, mass demonstration and rallies, and that's all. We know that now we have
now
this,
the opposition's getting more sophisticated.
Yes, but anyway, and the words, the lexicon, the rhetorics of both parts of this game, they are becoming simpler and simpler at the same time. So that is very dangerous, because if we can speak about a real, you know, happy future of Russian society and Russian state, the only right direction, it's my point of view, of course, but is a way from a simple industrial like society to a very sophisticated multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi, you know, social groups and so on, with a diversified economy and so on. And this way to sophistication has to be made with a very sophisticated tools and measures and so on, not with just, you know, boxing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what they've been doing.
And, you know, nuclear bombs and so on. It's kind of fencing.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, I want to throw something at you, and I'm going to throw a historical thing at you, basically. Nikita Khrushchev used to talk about the correlation of forces.
Yeah.
when he would argue that you couldn't look at the Soviet Union and the United States, or the East and the West Bloc, because all the working classes, he was wrong, but all the working classes in the West were really with the East Bloc. Now, he was wrong about that, but I want to take that concept and move it a little forward here. We have these two blocs facing each other, the Kremlin and the opposition, to put it in its most simplistic terms. But the Kremlin's divided, and there have been claims that there are ties between the technocratic managerial side of the Kremlin elite, or of the broader Russian elite, and the opposition. In fact, I read a quote by the renowned sociologist Olga Krasnovskaya, who knows a thing or two about the Russian elite, and she said there have been claims that the side of the elite that's disappointed in how things have turned out politically is giving financial and other kinds of support to the opposition. And now take this into this correlation of forces
argument.
In a great
secret, of course.
It's not a great secret, but it's the first time I saw somebody of her stature say it publicly. Now, if you have an alliance between the managerial, technocratic, pluralistic, what have you, whatever you want to call it, side of the Russian elite, and this increasingly sophisticated opposition, what does that portend?
I think that I respect Russian opposition so much, but I think that the initial, crackdown or crack inside the Putin's regime will come from Kremlin itself. I think so.
Well, I don't think the opposite, but if you have this alliance between the street and the technocratic side of the elite. And when we talk about the elite, we're not just talking about the big names like Surkov and Kudrin. We're talking about all the bureaucrats that staff all these government offices, many of whom in Medvedev during his presidency, and want to know another legacy of Medvedev. Medvedev promoted a lot of younger people into the bureaucracy.
And there is a division between the older.
These are names we don't read about in the newspaper every day. He also promoted some people whose names we do know about in the newspaper every day. But he promoted, and these people, for ideological reasons, they are younger and more in tune with this emerging culture in Russia, but they're also ambitious. And they saw a career path in a second term for Medvedev, which would have advanced all of their careers. And now they're disappointed, of course, ideologically, but they're disappointed in a career sense as well. And that these people sympathize with the street, with the Russian street, so to speak. This is another part. This is another. The crack is already there. But if you have an alliance between the street and a big, big chunk of the elite, including some very serious top people like Surkov and Kudrin, and an army of bureaucrats, that changes the picture and the way we look at it a little bit. It makes the picture a little bit more complicated, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think we began from Lenin and Marxism. And
we're coming to the end, so you're going to finish with Trotsky or something.
No, just with classical Marxism. We see that that this part of Kremlin, which are, not supporting the opposition, but are a little bit warmer to opposition than Sechen or Putin himself. They are the result of a post-industrial part of Russian economy. They connected not to, oil production and so on. They connected to high-tech production and so on, or to, some business around this. Yes, we can claim this. And the creative class is the result of the same part of the economy. And those who opposed them, or just on the streets as, opposition against Kremlin, or inside Kremlin, they're the product of the industrial economy.
Which is energy dominated.
Or energy dominated, and which is the legacy of Soviet Union. And only in this sense we can speak about, Soviet legacy in modern Russian politics. Just in this pure Marxist term or sense or meaning of this word. Because there are no any other, connections or similarities between this part of the elite with all their bank accounts in Switzerland and so on. And I think modest Russian Soviet leaders like Brezhnev.
So it all comes down to the means of production. It's the,
yes,
it's the,
yes,
it's the neo-Soviet, yes, oil heads, yes, against the hip,
yes,
tech heads.
Yes, yes. Industrial contra post-industrial.
On that note, we will wrap it up since, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service, who told me he was tired before the podcast, but I did not witness it during our recording. Thanks for the great discussion, Kirill.
Thank
it's
you,
good to have you.
You
back. I'd also like to thank our excellent producer, Tanya Koncheva. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.